Hello and welcome to this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Mary Roach. Mary has fearlessly tackled subjects in her previous two books that more timorous writers wouldn't dare to. The treatment of dead bodies in Stiff, and the weird and wonderful world of sex research in Bonk. In Packing for Mars, what she's interested in is the effect on human beings of space travel. What happens when you and everything around you is weightless? When you have to wear the same spacesuit for 2 weeks? When there's no prospect of escaping your fellow crew members? And what happens if you simply feel space sick? Mary is one of the most entertaining science writers around. I laughed aloud as I read Packing for Mars, but she never just plays it for laughs. You sense her own intense curiosity about what makes astronauts tick, not to mention the vast team of scientists who work on the space program and never get to travel into space. You also sense, and this is something which runs through all her books, her wonderment at just what a strange and marvellous thing the human body is. Listeners of a squeamish disposition should probably turn off now. What I wanted to know first was, given that NASA are very protective of their image, and not as renowned for their sense of humour as Mary is, had it been difficult to get people to talk to her about the less glamorous side of space travel?
Well, there were some topics where it was actually easier to fly all the way to Moscow and talk to cosmonauts to try to get sex, for example, in order to get someone to speak candidly on sex. You either have to go to a retired astronaut or talk to a cosmonaut, preferably a retired cosmonaut. That's actually the situation there, too. So it was a little bit difficult. NASA is they are used to promoting their achievements. They come from a military background to all the space agencies, and so, you know, they're not quite as freewheeling and easygoing about interviews as other types of researchers. So, yeah, I was banging my head against the wall a fair amount there.
Perhaps surprisingly, in the light of what you just said, you were allowed to witness such things as impact tests on a dead body being carried out.
Yes, and that was the result of probably 3 months and probably 50 or more emails back and forth. And in the end, the folks at Ohio State University who had read my book Stiff, which had to do with cadaver research, in the end they said to me, Mary, just show up and we'll deal with it. And so there was that morning there was a little bit of a scene when the people from NASA saw me there and realized that there was an observer that they hadn't been told about. So it was quite dramatic. And in the end, though, the woman at NASA they called her in a panic and said, there's this woman here with a notepad. And, you know, they told the students, don't speak to her. Don't talk to her. And they got on the phone, and there was this mad sort of back and forth telephoning. In the end, the woman at public affairs said, look, it's legitimate research that we're doing. She obviously feels very strongly about it. Just let her cover it. So they backed down in the end. But, yes, that was, I think, around the time where I thought, I quit. I can't do this book. I give up.
There's a lovely moment in the book where you're interviewing someone about the smell in a capsule after it lands and when the hatch is opened. And your interviewee says to you in apparently a very deadpan way, you're investigating a rather unusual aspect of space flight. And I thought that was kind of characteristic of the whole project, really. I mean, are you conscious of having quite an idiosyncratic set of questions when you come to an area like space flight?
Well, yes and no. I really do feel that my questions were the questions of the average person. They're not the things that NASA is most interested in and not the things that they like to talk about and promote, but they really are. It's the human side. It's because space is a place where there's nothing that we need to thrive is up there. Nothing works like it does here on Earth. So everything has to be rethought and relearned, and it's very surreal, very challenging, very strange, and often very disgusting. And it's that human side that everybody's curious about. But, you know, the astronauts themselves, I guess, they're used to talking about the heroics, you know, the triumphs and the tragedies and the big stuff. So it's just, I was after the stuff that kind of falls through the cracks.
And you set out to experience various things for yourself. Tell me about weightlessness. That was clearly quite a high point.
Yes, the weightlessness was, well, it was you get little tiny chunks of it at a time. You're on this plane called a C-9, and it's flying in this sort of roller coaster up and down, pulling out of a turn and coming back up. And when you go over and down, you have 22 seconds of weightlessness. You don't weigh anything. You weigh the same as the air around you, and you which is a wonderful kind of physical euphoria. Your organs inside your body suddenly don't have any weight. They're not, like, your heart's not pulling down on your aorta and your arms aren't pulling down on your shoulders. It's subtle, but there's this feeling of being freed from a weight you didn't even know was there. And it's just, there's nothing more comfortable than weightlessness, provided that you're not one of the poor guys in the back of the plane with a vomit bag pressed to his face. In that case, it's either the high point of your life or the low point, basically. Mm.
And also, one of the very big challenges for the space scientists dealing with the physiological effects of weightlessness on every aspect of human functioning.
Oh yes, the motion sickness is like 50 to 75% of astronauts suffer from it. And in the early days, it was thought that it wasn't manly to be getting sick and throwing up, and so no one talked about it. And it wasn't until Apollo 8, Rusty Schweikert was really the guy who brought it out of the closet and talked about it. You know, it affects all of the organs of the body, even the stomach. I mean, there was this famous Coke and Pepsi were trying to get carbonated beverages in space, which is the problem because the little bubbles don't float to the top. They just kind of hover and froth. And they finally figured it out. And then what they hadn't thought through was that the same thing happens inside the stomach. The gas doesn't rise to the top where the opening is, so it's very uncomfortable and messy to burp. So after they spent $500,000 getting carbonated beverages for zero gravity, no one would drink them.
I love the quotidian, the non-heroic exchanges that you reproduced in the book between astronauts and mission control, because again, we're used to very profound sort of prophetic statements in quotations, but clearly a lot of the conversations about very banal things like skincare.
Oh, yeah, Gemini 7, it was a two-week mission where one of the questions they were answering is, well, what will happen if you don't take a shower and you wear a spacesuit for 2 weeks, 24 hours a day? So the flight surgeon would come on, you know, periodically and go, Frank, you know, Frank Borman was the commander. Frank, are you having any dandruff problem up there? You know, or Jim, is Frank perspiring a lot? Can you tell? How much lotion do you have left? Is that working for you? And Frank Borman would sometimes ignore the flight surgeon, obviously that it was compromising the whole manliness of the mission. It was just these wonderful moments in the midst of all this technical, you know, jargon and kind of space talk. There would be these wonderful human moments.
And you set out to either verify or to debunk certain myths that have been doing the rounds. I mean, you devote some energy to trying to track down some footage of a masturbating space chimp, don't you?
Yeah, well, I cleared the name of this one chimp. Enos was the second space chimp. The first one, everybody knows Ham. Ham was the first to go up before Alan Shepard was the first American. Obviously not the first person, that was Yuri Gagarin. But the Enos gets very little publicity, this poor chimp. And on top of that, you know, Enos orbited the Earth before John Glenn. But everybody, you know, big deal. We'd already heard about Ham. So everyone kind of forgot about him, except that there was this rumor that Enos, whose nickname was Enos the Penis, this rumor that came from the nickname that Enos had a proclivity for fondling himself, and that in fact he'd done this while he was orbiting. And I was interested in this for my Sex in Space chapter. I thought, well, here's obviously the first person who had sex in space, albeit in a solitary manner. However, I contacted Enos's trainers, and in fact, that's not the case. They said, Mary, all male chimps play with themselves. And second, we called him that because he was just a son of a gun, you know, meaning he was a bit of a dick.
I also love the fact that you tried to track down a porn film which purported to show sex and zero gravity. And I love the detail that the cameraman in that was reputed to have worked for Ingmar Bergman. I thought that was a lovely detail.
I know. I couldn't believe it. And I love it. Not only that, but the owner of the porn production company, we got into this conversation. We were saying he's putting down the films of Bergman. He goes, there's just no joy in those films. Nobody watched them all the way through. And I have to say, having seen the Uranus experiments, which is the porn film in question, that there was a lot more joy in that than your average Bergman film. But no zero gravity sex, sadly.
No, you'd done enough research to know that it was faked, hadn't you?
Yeah, it was pretty obvious to tell. Her ponytail is hanging down her back, which it wouldn't be, and she didn't have that marvelous buoyancy that female breasts do have in zero gravity, which you can see on Girls Gone Wild, which did shoot some footage not of intercourse, but just naked, floating co-eds.
Now, to return to the astronauts and leave the porn stars behind. I mean, did you sort of form a sense of what makes them tick? Because I mean, you say at one point there are astronauts who'd be willing to go on a one-way mission to Mars. You know, that the mission is so glorious in their imaginations that they wouldn't even worry about getting back. So, are they really a breed apart from us lesser mortals?
I think that they are, in a sense, just and I say this from some of the more mundane things that I observed. One time I was watching NASA TV, and Peggy Whitson, who was the commander of the International Space Station, was talking to someone at Mission Control, and he says to her, "Commander Whitson, those photographs that you spent this morning taking, we can't find those. Those are, I don't know, they're gone." And she just calmly says, "That's not a problem. We'll do them over." You know, if it was me, I would have said, "Well, look again, lamb chop. Come on, I spent the entire morning. I've got a lot of things to do up here. You've got to be kidding me." I mean, they are unflappable people. They are so focused on space, wanting to be in space. I think that I'm not that personality type at all, so it's hard for me to relate. But I do think that a lot of people focus on the physical discomforts, the restricted hygiene and the cramped space and the lack of good food But I think, you know, I'm someone who likes to go backpacking, and that is a similar, on a very small scale. You've got, you can't bring along the comforts of home. It's a very sort of pared-down existence. But it's so worth it for where you go and the views that you get and the sense of being somewhere where so few people have been. And I think space is that times a thousand. So these are people who are so focused on wanting to be in space that they don't, the rest of that stuff, the physical discomforts and all that, it doesn't really bother them. And they're very, they're extremely high achieving, very focused individuals. And they are a bit of a breed apart.
Mary, I wanted to compliment you on your footnotes. They were a delight at the bottom of many pages. I learned amazing things from them, such as the fact that pigs, which were used in crash simulations, found their way onto the barbecue by the end of the day and were eaten in the mess room. You obviously delight in those quirky little details that the history throws up.
Yeah, I'm a little indulgent as a writer. I find these things, and even when they don't really fit the narrative, I can't bear to leave them out, so I'll just stick them in a footnote at the bottom of the page.
Let me ask you, finally then, you come around at the end of the book to address the question, not is Mars possible, but is Mars worth it? How do you come down on that question yourself?
Well, I think a Mars mission, the answer, yes, I do think it's worth it, provided a couple of things. Number one, that it would be an international cooperative effort where you have all these different nations contributing funding and expertise and technology, and so that it wouldn't be a financial burden on one nation. And I also think that not since Apollo has the whole planet been watching something positive like that, and plus the technology that would come out of a Mars mission. Because any time you try to do anything in space, you have to rethink everything, and you get all this technology that comes out of it. In the case of Mars, you get a lot of sort of extreme recycling and sustainability type of developments that could probably be pretty useful here. So I do think it would be worth it. People talk about, well, you could, what if you spent that money here on Earth, you know, whatever, how many billions of dollars here on Earth? And I'd say, yes, you know, if you could guarantee me that money would be spent on, say, cancer research or education, then I would say, no, let's not go to Mars, let's spend it here. But it never works that way, you know? It's always wasted on something.
Yeah, you make the point that a Mars mission would probably cost about the same as the Iraq war has cost to date.
Right. Yeah, so for that reason, I think it makes a lot more sense for it to be an international cooperative effort, like the International Space Station has been for the past 10 years.
And on a lighthearted note, but also, I think, a truthful one, you say it would be the ultimate reality TV, and I guess we've all been sort of limbering up for watching a Mars mission by all the reality TV that's been broadcast in the last decade or so.
It would be, you could think of the advertising dollars. I mean, everyone would be watching. Unfortunately, the ideal Mars candidate would be someone in their 60s because of radiation issues. So that, you know, that kind of puts a bit of a damper on the reality TV aspect of it.
Mary Roach. Packing for Mars is out now in hardback. And her previous books, also highly recommended, are called Stiff and Bonk and are out now in paperback. You can find out more about these books, plus several million others, by going to blackwell.co.uk. I hope you can join me again soon for another Blackwell Online podcast, and until then, thank you very much for listening. and goodbye.